This is VOA News. Reporting via remote, I'm Jeff Custer. Afghanistan's ruling Taliban said a powerful earthquake in the nation's southeast early Wednesday has killed more than 1,000 people and injured hundreds of others. Rescue workers said the casualties from the quake, which struck during the early hours of Wednesday, were likely to increase. Deputy Taliban Minister for Disaster Management, Malawi Sherifuddin Muslim, told reporters in the capital, Kabul, that most of the devastation occurred in the southeastern Paktika and coast provinces, which border Pakistan. The U.S. Geological Survey said the magnitude 6.1 quake struck about 44 kilometers from the provincial capital of Khost. Local journalists and witnesses reported the death toll could be as high as 2,500. International aid groups wasted no time getting their crews into the country to help local officials find and treat survivors and get aid where it was needed. Afghanistan Communications Chief for the UN Children's Fund, UNICEF, Samantha Mort, told the Associated Press they're doing what they can to help out.
UNICEF does have mobile health and nutrition teams in some of the most affected districts, ministering first aid to those most in need. And we also have trucks on the road already full of critical aid supplies like blankets and tents and tarpaulins, kitchen supplies, water supplies, hygiene supplies to help those most in need.
A spokesman from the International Committee for the Red Cross warned because of the remote area where the quake was centered, it may take days for the world to discover exactly how bad the earthquake truly was. The mayor of the southern Ukrainian city of Mykolaiv said Wednesday Russian missile strikes killed at least one person and damaged buildings, including a school in that city. Mayor Alexander Senkevich said the attacks caused fires, damaged a number of residential and business buildings, and left smoke hanging over the port city. This is VOA News. British health officials reported Wednesday polio has been detected in sewage samples in London, the first sign since 1980s that the virus could be spreading in the country. Britain's Health Security Agency said the risk of infection from the disease was low because of high vaccination rates in the country. Polio causes paralysis in children in under 1% of cases. The agency nevertheless encouraged parents to make sure their children were vaccinated after the discovery of the virus during routine wastewater surveillance, particularly those children who may have missed shots during the COVID-19 pandemic. Nationwide polio vaccination levels in Britain are about 90%, are above the 90% needed to prevent outbreaks, but London's coverage rates among children under the age of 2 has dipped below that in recent years. The U.S. Congressional panel investigating the causes of last year's January 6th riot at the U.S. Capitol will hold its fifth public hearing Thursday and hear testimony regarding how former U.S. President Donald Trump pushed Justice Department officials to investigate allegations of fraud in the 2020 elections that he hoped would upend his loss to Democrat Joe Biden. The House Select Committee Chairman Benny Thompson said the panel would examine Trump's attempt to corrupt the country's top law enforcement body, much as state officials in Arizona and Georgia testified Tuesday that Trump had unsuccessfully sought to get them to appoint bogus electors to help him stay in office for another 4 years or overturn votes showing Biden had defeated him. During Tuesday's hearing, the committee also focused on what they said were Trump's efforts to pressure state election officials and workers to overturn state election results. The committee's investigators said Trump's lies had a human cost on election workers who faced death threats after he alleged they falsified ballots. One such worker who appeared before the committee was former Georgia election worker Ruby Freeman, who Trump, with no evidence, called out by name.
We had him counted 18,000 voters having to do with Ruby Freeman. She's a vote scammer, a professional vote scammer and hustler.
Do you know how it feels to have the President of the United States to target you? The President of the United States is supposed to represent every American, not to target one.
An international financial and management consulting firm reported Wednesday electric vehicle sales could reach 33% globally by 2028 and 54% by 2035 as demand accelerates for the vehicles in most major markets. In its annual Global Automotive Outlook briefing, Alexis Partners said to support that demand, automakers and suppliers now expect to invest at least $500 million on EVs. Reporting via remote, I'm Jeff Custer. This is VOA News.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yeheyes Wuhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
Tax revenues are important because, you know, that's the way you capture the rate of return on all the investments. So you build a road, you build an electric power station. It's important that you find ways in which you are able to repay the loans that you've taken towards that. And our countries, we've not done enough of a good job, you know, in terms of mobilizing tax revenue.
That was Ababa Amro Selassie, the head of the International Monetary Fund's African Department, on how COVID-19 and Russia invasion of Ukraine have affected African countries' debt load. Details coming up. Also, Congolese independence hero Patrice Lumumba's remains have been returned to the DRC after 61 years. But first, our top story. Tensions between Rwanda and the Democratic Republic of Congo remain high as the M23 rebels try to take more territory. Many Congolese blame Rwanda's government for the violence in the eastern DRC and say Kigali backs the M23, a mainly Tutsi ethnic group. Rwanda denies those accusations. Over the weekend, there were scattered attacks on people seen as linked to Rwanda, including Tutsi speakers of Kinyarwanda and Rwandan citizens who do business in the eastern DRC. Espar Naluki is an activist with the civil society group Luka in Goma. He says the group is trying to prevent such attacks and urges the DRC government to act to bring peace to the troubled region. He spoke with reporter Jafar Al-Ketanti today in Goma.
For us, the problem of Congo is the Rwandan government, not Rwandese people. But if we had xenophobia, many Congolese who are Tutsi and many Rwandese could not live here in our country. But they are living, they are investing, they are teaching, they are learning, but peacefully. If we were xenophobia, those people could not live here.
What's your organization, La Lucha, concerned about this current situation?
For our organization, La Lucha, we've already condemned those cases. And we called people and we called government to protect every Congolese. Hutu, Tutsi, others like Shi, Tembo, all tribes have to be protected in the same way. And for us, we are personally, the member of La Lucha, have showing up their opinion that to condemn those cases of xenophobia and to condemn the attitude of our government to not protect Congolese who are victim and real victim, because real victim are those Congolese who are living in violent area.
So what do you think the government can do to help?
The government can do many things. The first one is to bring the good situation, is to bring us the peace and the security. The second thing, the government have to condemn those people who are sharing violent messages on social media, on traditional media. And the government have to change in the long-term goal. The government have to show to manage the current education, to show people that in our country we have many tribes. We have Tutsi among Congolese tribes, we have Hutu among Congolese tribes, and the government have to show people that the problem is not Rwandese citizens. The problem is the government of Rwanda. Not only for the government, but is even us, the civil society. We have to show people that the problem, they are not Rwandese. It's another thing that the government have to do is to bring the good diplomacy among our neighbors and to tell us the truth, what happened really. And the last thing is to bring the justice. We need justice in our country, because without justice, we'll not have peace, any peace.
That was Espar Naluki with the civil society group Luka in Goma. He spoke with journalist Jafar Al-Ketanti.
Thank you.
As the UN-led talks between rival Libyans failed to reach a deal on rules for election, another conflict complicated the political scene. Libya's parliament unanimously approved the 2022 $18.6 billion 2022 budget to finance the government of Bashagha, who has been unable to enter the capital Tripoli to take over from the National Unity government that rejects his appointment. Wolfgang Poschdai, former Austrian military attaché in Libya, discussed the risk of greater split in the war-torn country or push Libya back into administrative partition and war, with VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi.
This certainly increases the pressure on the Central Bank of Libya, who funds the government, and on Government of National Unity Prime Minister Abdulhamid Dabeiba. Bashagha said he expects the CBL to fund the budget, but I would say this is rather unlikely. Keeping the ongoing oil blockades and the increasing frustration, especially in the eastern part of Libya, but also in the south, in the Fezzan, in mind, this will certainly raise the tensions, and it could eventually lead to a renewed armed conflict at a later stage. Dabeiba is acting in a very clever way, inviting delegations from eastern cities and from eastern tribes to Tripoli, discussing with them about various projects and providing some funds, while Bashagha has nothing to deliver. It is difficult to say how long the Bashagha government can survive without money, but its practical influence and its relevance will certainly remain very limited.
The Central Bank of Libya, which is based in Tripoli and is the only internationally recognized depository for Libyan oil revenues, still financing the rival Dabeiba's government. Libya analysts say if the CBL refuses to fund Bashagha's budget, the parliament may ask the head of its eastern branch to do so, effectively ending the CBL reunification process. Is that feasible?
Not really. They simply don't have the money to do so. They would need at least access to the oil revenues. But the buyers of Libyan oil and gas need to pay the money to the bank accounts of the National Oil Corporation at the Libyan Foreign Bank. And from there, the money is usually transferred to accounts of the Central Bank of Libya in Tripoli, where Prime Minister Dabeiba's government has access to them. I don't expect the Libyan Foreign Bank or the National Oil Corporation to transfer the revenues from the Libyan Foreign Bank to CBL East accounts in Benghazi or Tobruk. They did not do so over the previous years when there was also a parallel government in the East, and I don't see a reason why this should change now. And it is also highly unlikely that countries like Saudi Arabia or the United Arab Emirates would be ready to fund the Bashagha government of national stability.
The parliament-appointed Prime Minister Fathi Bashagha said Libya's oil blockade would likely end if the central bank supplies the funds for the budget that parliament approved this week. What do you make of that?
This could be very well the case, as Bashagha could fulfill through this one of the key demands of those who are protesting. He could distribute the oil revenues more evenly throughout the three parts of the country. Furthermore, this would certainly also be a severe blow for the Dabeiba government, as this would probably cut it off from the funds it needs to survive. And without the money, it would be difficult for Dabeiba over time to stay in power. However, currently, it does not look like CBL Governor Sadiq al-Kabir will change his approach and he will finance the government of national support. I guess he will stay on the side of Dabeiba and continue to finance his government. And as the CBL has its seat in Tripoli, it would be probably also difficult for him to do so under the watchful eyes of the militias supporting Dabeiba.
That was Wolfgang Poschdai, former Austrian military attaché in Libya, speaking with VOA's Mohamed El-Shenawi. Police in Namibia have denied helping South African President Cyril Ramaphosa to cover up a robbery on his farm. South Africa's former intelligence chief Arthur Fraser has alleged that Namibian criminals stole between $4 and $8 million in cash from Ramaphosa's game ranch 2 years ago. Fraser claims the crime was covered up because the president came by the cash illegally, which Ramaphosa denies. Darren Taylor reports.
The president insists the cash, much less than $4 million, according to him, was from a sale of rare game animals. He breeds species such as the almost extinct oryx antelope on his luxury Palapala ranch in Limpopo province. Ramaphosa acknowledged that his personal protection unit did not register an official police case about the robbery, but he hasn't explained why not. Fraser says it wasn't done because the president illegally sent his unit to Namibia to capture the suspects, bring them back to South Africa, torture them, and recover the cash. Ramaphosa denies all of that. But a recent statement by Namibia's police inspector general has lent more credence to Fraser's affidavit. The statement says in June 2020, a few months after the robbery, Namibian police identified individuals and bank accounts linked to properties suspected to have been bought with proceeds of crime. They wanted to freeze the assets, but could only do so once authorities in South Africa confirmed that a robbery had indeed happened at Ramaphosa's ranch. When this confirmation failed to arrive, say the Namibians, they were forced to suspend their investigation, and the suspects remain free. Political analyst Sipho Siepe says the evidence mounting against Ramaphosa is increasingly damning.
When there is a crime and the other police jurisdictions are saying, assist us, and you choose not to do so, you are participating in what people call defeating the interests of justice. That cannot be allowed, especially when you have somebody who has always told us that whenever there's a crime, we must get to the bottom of it. Somebody who has been preaching the notion of transparency.
Advocate Paul Hoffman, director of Accountability Now, says Ramaphosa's being everything but transparent.
If the animals that were sold were wild animals, buffalo or oryx, nobody's told me exactly what was sold, then permits from the state vet were required. And if permits weren't obtained, then that sale was an unlawful transaction and the money was stitched into the furniture at Pala Pala because of the desire to conceal the unlawful transaction.
According to Fraser's affidavit, the cash was hidden inside a sofa. Hoffman says it doesn't matter where the cash was. What matters is that a large amount of foreign currency was stored somewhere on Ramaphosa's ranch.
Did the president have permission to do so? If he did, well and good, no harm in that. If he didn't, what is his explanation? Are there VAT returns in respect of the sale?
Ramaphosa says he's never touched illicit money, has always paid his taxes, and an investigation into the matter will prove just that. Siepe doesn't have faith in that investigation.
As long as the president sits there, those who report to him, especially if they are career professionals, are not likely to pursue these issues of making sure that the president is held to account.
The former chairman of Parliament's Public Accounts Committee, Themba Gordhi, says citizens no longer trust Ramaphosa.
Whatever the outcome of the investigation, I think so far, the impression created that might be very hard to erase is that President Ramaphosa is not different from any other ANC leader. They talk left and they act right.
Opposition parties and civil society groups are calling on the president to stop hiding behind what they're calling the false cover of a pending investigation. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
Foreign donors cut off aid to Sudan after the military overthrew the joint civilian-military transitional government last October 27th. The cut in aid, which accounts for 40% of state revenues, prompted military leader Abdel Fattah al-Burhan to agree to the so-called Trioka talks process earlier this month, which included the United Nations and the Eastern Regional Grouping, IGAD. But the French news agency AFP reports the talks have been undermined by a boycott of established political parties, as well as groups born out of the mass protests that led to former dictator Bashir's ouster. The African Union, which suspended Sudan after the military overthrow, also has said it will not be a party to talks that exclude significant actors. Since United States envoys failed to persuade the opposition civilian groups to give the talks a chance, the process has been put on hold indefinitely. Belgian authorities have returned a tooth of murdered Congolese independence hero Patrice Lumumba to his children in a new move towards recognition of atrocities that accompanied Belgium's brutal exploitation of its former colony. The relic is all that remains of Lumumba, the first prime minister of the Democratic Republic of the Congo. The gold-capped tooth was handed over in a light blue case to a group of family members at the Egmont Palace in Brussels on Monday morning. It arrived in the DRC today. Jean-Jacques Lumumba, an activist and a recipient of the International Award for Fighting Corruption, is the grandson of Patrice Lumumba. He talked to me from Paris today about the ceremony for the remains.
You know, I prefer to talk about the Patrice Lumumba's body remains, his mortal remains, but not the tooth, because it brings back to me his heinous and horrible act. You know, I feel a lot of emotions, and I talk of two companions, Maurice Mpolo and Victor Okito, his wife, Pauline Opango, and his son, Patrice Lumumba. Both died in 2014. Lumumba family, who suffered exile, repression in name of their brother, we would have all wanted to see this day filled with emotions. But it's tough for the Congolese people, for whom the death of Lumumba and his comrade Mpolo and Okito represent the beginning of the cycle of impunity, of the dawn of our succession to independence until today.
So what do you think? What is the significance of returning the remains? Is Belgium trying to put behind one of the most brutal and shameful episodes in the country's bloody exploitation of Central Africa?
You know, this event is only the beginning of the clarification of this process. The apologies of the King Philip and the Prime Minister De Croo, whom we salute, cannot replace the role of justice today.
Yes, you said a crime has been committed, and a great crime was committed in the assassination of your grandfather and a few others in 1961. So, you know, it's very hard to express it to you, but he was killed, dissolved his remains in acid, and kept his tooth as a memento. Will there ever be justice for this grisly deed? Will the family together demand justice?
I insist about justice for men, because justice is the only useful option to build a bright future. You know, the memory of our million of victims of yesterday and today deserves to be respected and to be honored. Congolese like justice, and Lumumba family like justice.
That was Jean-Jacques Lumumba, the grandson of murdered Congolese independence hero Patrice Lumumba, speaking with me from Paris today. Are African countries carrying too much debt? And how will a country's debt burden affect its ability to cope and recover from the current global economic crisis? The head of the International Monetary Fund's African Department, Ababa Amaro Selassie, says the COVID-19 pandemic battered economies everywhere, and that food and fuel shortages due in large part to Russia's invasion of Ukraine has only made things worse. Heidi Adams, host of VOA Straight Talk Africa, sat down with Amaro Selassie at the IMF's headquarters here in Washington to discuss the impact of the global economic downturn on African economies.
I'm glad you brought up the pandemic, because of course it saw countries around the world spend significant amounts of money in 2020, especially to combat the effects of the pandemic. And that meant that debt levels increased worldwide. We saw Zambia, for instance, default in 2020. In your view, are African countries right now carrying too much debt, given the situation we've come out of or are sort of coming out of, and given the situation we are currently in globally?
I think even before the pandemic, what we had seen was countries that have been pursuing quite a lot of investment projects, infrastructure investment, health, education, quite a lot, borrowing to invest in these areas, but not doing as well in terms of collecting tax revenues. Tax revenues are important because, that's the way you capture the rate of return on all the investment. So you build a road, you build an electric power station. It's important that you find ways in which you are able to repay the loans that you've taken towards that. And our countries, we've not done enough of a good job, in terms of mobilizing tax revenues. So reflecting that, debt levels had gone up in many countries. And then you have, of course, have the effects of the pandemic. What that did, of course, was it dampened economic activity, it hit tax revenues, and required governments to spend more. So debt levels went up another notch in the vast majority of countries. As a result of this, some countries have gone into a default situation, or the risk of debt vulnerability has gone up in a lot of countries. And as you said, countries like Zambia, Chad is another one, have had to turn to their creditors and seek debt restructuring. And because African countries, we have limited alternative access to capital markets, domestic markets are weaker, the type of resilience mechanisms that many other countries have in an advanced world and large emerging markets, the debt situation is more acute in our countries than it is elsewhere. But again, even within this context, it really is important that, the situation of whether debt is sustainable or not is a fairly dynamic one, a country-specific one, and one that depends on the economic outlook.
Home Affairs. Please note, we have moved our programs from voanews.com to voaafrica.com. There you'll find all your favorite VOA radio and TV programs and a whole lot more. You can find us on voaafrica.com. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbili Abaro, and our engineer, Vasco Volarech, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for an hour of awesome African music. Wake up, dance this music. Like to stay on top of new music trends, breakout artists, new releases? Maybe you just love the classic styles and artists of the past. Or simply the sound and feel of a good beat. Whatever your pleasure, you can get it every week right here on Music Time in Africa. So join me on your local FM station, Saturdays and Sundays at 1500 and 2000 UTC.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of Press Conference USA, VOA's newsmaker interview program. Join us each Saturday and Sunday when we talk with authors, analysts, and policymakers who provide fresh insight on topics ranging from U.S. politics and foreign policy to science, culture, and global health. You can listen to Press Conference USA on the radio or online at voanews.com/PCUSA. While you're visiting our website, be sure to subscribe to our podcast. We'd also love to hear from you. Just send an email to pcusa@voanews.com or connect with us on Facebook at facebook.com/CarolCastielVOA or on Twitter at CarolCastielVOA. That's Press Conference USA every Saturday and Sunday on the